Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
What if there was a way to feel younger for longer? Well, there is. Your body needs something called the NAD plus molecule to help you age well. When you're young, your body makes a lot of NAD plus, and that helps you make energy, it helps you keep your DNA healthy, absorb nutrients well, and it protects your cells from stress. But once you hit about 30, your NAD plus levels start to drop. The good news is that longevity scientists have found some things that can help, like niacin, niacinamide, and Niagen. They help your body make more NAD plus even as you age. All three of these are in an amazing formula called Qualia NAD plus. Check out Qualia NAD plus risk-free for up to 100 days at neurohacker.com/Dave15 to save an extra 15%. That's neurohacker.com/Dave15, Qualia NAD plus. It's what I use. What if there was a way to level up your energy, get rid of stress, and take more control of your body? Welcome to Quantum Upgrade. This is a new technology that taps into quantum energy to help you feel amazing. Quantum Upgrade has a lot of different products that help protect you from EMF and help activate your body's natural healing abilities. You can expect better sleep, more resilience, less stress, and better blood flow. The cool thing about Quantum Upgrade is that the products are backed by a lot of heavy-duty scientific studies, and there's a new measurable upgrade. You can now use Quantum Upgrade to increase your consciousness levels between 1400 and 2200 on the Hawkins map of consciousness. If you don't know what that means, do some research because it's impressive, it's fun to learn about, and it's something that I've come to understand. Ready to try Quantum Upgrade? Visit quantumupgrade.io/Dave for a 7-day free trial.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bulletproof Radio. I'm Dave Asprey. And yes, I have a little bit of laryngitis caused by sitting in my hyperbaric oxygen chamber without putting the oxygen through water the way you're supposed to. My own fault, dried myself out. But hey, I'm all oxygenated, so maybe it was worth it. Today's cool fact of the day is that in the 1800s and 1900s, doctors used to give tobacco smoke enemas as emergency resuscitators. The theory was that the warm smoke would warm your body and start breathing. I probably don't have to tell you, but that treatment didn't have a great success rate. Turns out, though, there is an effect of nicotine on oxygen levels in the brain, so maybe they had some little inkling of that, but I don't think that's really something I'd recommend anymore.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's guest needs no introduction. He is none other than Dr. Joseph Mercola, founder of the number one natural health site on the internet, mercola.com, with 1.5 million subscribers. He's written 3 New York Times bestsellers, The Great Bird Flu Hoax, The No Grain Diet, and Effortless Healing. You've seen him on just about every major media outlet. And he's also kind of a tech guy, a computer hobbyist since the mid-80s, with an interest in the internet that led him to create his website in 1997. Dr. Mercola, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you on.
Well, thank you for having me, Dave. Appreciate it.
I'm going to do my best to keep my voice strong during this, but this is probably the lowest quality voice I've had, but I wanted to make sure I got you on the show to talk about Effortless Healing because it's coming out in softcover pretty soon.
Yes, paperback, real soon.
You've been one of those guys I've wanted to have on the show for a long time because you've written extensively for going on almost 97 to 2007, or going on more than 15 years now, of just consistently writing stuff that oftentimes doesn't match the mainstream. You're one of the guys who's actively stood up and invested a lot of your personal assets in fighting for GMO labeling just so people can know whether it's in their food or not. And you've also stepped up on a bunch of other controversial issues. And the number one question that I think listeners want to know about, and what I want to know about, is what's motivating you? Like, why do you do this?
Well, I'm just passionate about health. You know, somewhat of it is a bit of selfish perspective, because I want to know as much as I can about how to stay healthy myself, and which is one of the reasons why I started the newsletter, in learning from breaking news and information that the leading scientists have dedicated large more amounts of their lives, have taken decades to figure out, and then they've published these findings, and then I wanted to know about it. I figured if it's interesting to me, it's probably interesting to a lot of other people. And it turns out it is. The challenge with most physicians is that they're trained in this jargon that makes it almost incomprehensible to communicate with most individuals. So we've simplified the terminology and the words, and really seek to communicate in a clear, concise way the information that drives me to learn more about health, and many people find it helpful.
What changes have you had in your personal health or your personal performance over the past number of years that you've been doing this? Like, what have you done to yourself that really has changed things for you?
Well, it's life is a journey, and health is a journey too. And I'm always learning new things. So it probably is best to work backwards, because it's kind of hard to remember all of them. But I've learned so much from having the opportunity to interview some really incredible people and some novel ideas. But the most recent one probably was not sitting down. I've been an athlete most of my life. I started exercising in 1968 and even ran a 250 marathon. And if I ran that a century ago, it would have been a world record, but I ran mine in the early 80s. I thought I was in good shape, but after I stopped, was transitioned to full-time editor on the newsletter, I was doing a lot more sitting than when I was seeing patients. So I had this progressively increasing back pain that troubled me quite a bit. And I was seeing a number of different chiropractors, really incredibly good chiropractors, into different stretches and strengthening exercises, inversion tables, lasers, infrared saunas, you name it. I did dozens and dozens of different strategies, and yet the pain persisted, never got better, until I finally learned about sitting down and not the importance of not sitting down. And I learned that from Dr. Vernikos initially, who was one of the scientists that was responsible for taking care of the astronauts' health. And she just helped me understand the importance of not sitting, but what I was doing is still sit down and stand up every 10 to 15 minutes. And that didn't work. I tried that for 6 months to a year, until I interviewed Dr. Levine, who is one of the leading researchers in this area out of the Mayo Clinic. And he convinced me just to stand up. So I did that, basically eliminated almost all of my sitting. I sit for less than 30 minutes a day, typically. And my back pain has never returned, unless I'm forced to sit for prolonged periods, like on a plane or a long car ride. So that was important.
A few people have commented that I'm standing up for my podcast as well. When I record these things, I just about always stand up. And you're only the second guest out of 200 and pushing 240 guests now who also stood up, except for Kelly Starrett, who is a functional movement.
Yeah, I've interviewed Kelly too. I love Kelly.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. He's a great guy. And he's doing a stand-up actually desks at his kid's school right now.
But yeah. He's a real innovator. I just like his personality.
He's good. He's very enthusiastic and all.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting, though, out of 200 and something people, many of them health and movement nutrition experts, the number of people who are standing up, you, Kelly, and me. Why?
Yeah. Why do it's new information. And, I was skeptical for the longest time before I really applied it personally. I just didn't make sense. I thought that this exercise I was doing was more than enough to compensate for it. But the studies are really clear, really, really clear. And there's thousands of them that say that you could be exercising an hour, 2 hours a day, be a professional athlete. And if you're sitting 12 to 16 hours a day, no amount of exercise is going to compensate for that. It's just metabolically, you can't. And then physically and structurally too, at least for me, it was a big issue. So I think there's this disbelief. And somewhat like there was with smoking. In fact, that many people call sitting the new smoking. But it's the same thing. People were in disbelief when they were smoking. They didn't understand that it can cause loads of disease, heart disease and cancer. So, but now we know. So that was one.
Okay, that was one.
I had a girlfriend 7-8 years ago that got me into eating some bad eating patterns, and I gained about 10 pounds. I was up to almost 200 pounds, and it wasn't muscle. So I had extra body fat. I must have been up to like 20% or so, and learned about intermittent fasting and the importance of that. And so that was a huge benefit in my life, but then also learned that it's not something you do all the time.
Yeah, it'll break your adrenals, yeah, right?
Definitely, it's targeted for a specific time. And usually when you get rid of your insulin resistance, then you don't need it anymore. And it could be a problem. You can lose way too much weight if you continue in something like that. And you're working out pretty extensively. So you have to be careful. But most people don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, so that's a fair point. It seems like you've over the years you've definitely added intermittent fasting and maybe you've increased the amount of fat in your in your recommendations. What led you to increase fat in the nutritional stuff that you write about?
Well, you don't really have much of an option, you know. I'm a big fan of Dr. Ron Rosedale, yeah, who was one of my early mentors. He really is the person who first made me aware of the importance of insulin resistance in 1995. So 20 years ago, I was at a meeting with him in Chicago. It was maybe 20 of us in the room. It was a small natural medicine meeting. And he went on for 3 hours about diabetes and insulin resistance. And it was a new topic to me, but it's really, even now, 20 years later, the central core of my understanding of why most people get sick is because they have insulin resistance. It's pervasive. So in order to address that, you have to lower your carbohydrates, and then too much protein is a problem because that also increases insulin. Then you're really left with fat, and then you just have to differentiate the types of fat to healthy fats. So, you know, at one time I was eating 70-80% fat, but now that I'm not insulin resistant and my body fat is pretty much ideal, about 11% or so, I probably have a lot more fruit now than I typically do, and some grains. So maybe 40% fat or so, somewhere around there.
Grains, but no wheat and no gluten, I'm assuming.
No wheat, no. I like quinoa.
Okay.
Some rice.
Quinoa and rice. Why quinoa versus rice?
Quinoa is really high in protein, and it balances it out. It's just adds variety to my diet. Is one of the reasons I picked it. And it seems to be a pretty decent grain, and some other nutrients in there.
And from the fruit perspective, there's all this stuff written, and a lot of which I support, about fructose and triglycerides, fructose and cancer, fructose and advanced glycosylation, aging of tissues and all. There are a group of people who say, well, fruit doesn't count because it has fiber that kind of cancels out the fructose effect. Where do you fall in your perspective on fructose from fruit versus fructose from high fructose corn syrup? I know one's better than the other, but should we still care about fruit?
Oh, absolutely. And I would not advise the majority of people watching this, although your audience might be a little bit different than mine, to consume large amounts of fruit. It's probably an unwise idea if you're insulin resistant. So how do you know if you're insulin resistant? Well, are you overweight? Are you diabetic? Are you having problems with high blood pressure? Or are you taking statin drugs? If any of those conditions, or even better, have your doctor measure your fasting insulin level. And if any of those show that you have insulin resistance, then it's probably wise to stay away from fruit, or at least have it in small quantities. So basically, we recommend less than 15 grams of fructose a day. So obviously, there's a wide range of fructose in fruit, depending on which one you choose. So as long as you keep it low, you're probably okay. But if you have insulin resistance, you want to be really careful. If you don't, then you can have it and just monitor those other variables. And as long as they're normal, you're probably okay. So there's nothing. You definitely don't want high fructose corn syrup, because that's an unnatural product. And one of the, you know, being healthy really isn't that hard. That's what I learned after 30 years of studying health. It gets down to some pretty simple basics. And one of them is to eat real food. What a concept, you know. So stay away from processed foods. So that's one of the reasons why you want to avoid high fructose corn syrup. An orange, a mango, a tangerine, these are real foods. Now, if you have them in high amounts and you have insulin resistance, it's a problem, but it's still a real food. So that's what you want to focus on. So that's a simple principle, and it works really quite well. And the fiber in the fruit is also important to modulate some of them, the spikes in the insulin. Although Dr. Rosedale would probably disagree with my perspective on this, I still think it's probably okay. I've gone back and forth on it, but I'm at the point now where I think it's okay. In fact, I have like 5 dozen fruit trees on my property that I've planted and are producing, in the process of producing fruit. So
there's also the pleasure principle. Fruit tastes good. And so
absolutely. Yeah.
I recommend in from my research, like if you're going to have it probably at dinner or after dinner, get a little bit of the serotonin effect from it, but keep your overall levels low. And if you're having fruit for breakfast, fruit for lunch, fruit for dinner, because fruits and vegetables are good for you together, like they're the same thing, that you're probably not going to like what happens, especially if you do it every day.
Yeah. You know, and you have it seasonally too. Ideally, that's best to grow it yourself. I live in Florida, so I have an opportunity to grow a lot of different fruit trees.
That's kind of cheating, isn't it? Because you grow fruit year round.
It doesn't bear fruit year round. I don't live in Southern Florida, so they can do that. But most of the year, we're able to harvest some type of fruit.
And I'm up in Canada and we just planted a few trees, but we'll have, you know, 4 week season where there's fruit. So
yeah, you're really restricted to apples, pears.
Yeah. A few cherries when we're looking.
Yeah. Cherries would be good up there too. Yeah. The cherries down in Florida aren't as good.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And the avocados in Florida, let's talk avocados. Yes. They're one of your favorite foods. They're one of my favorite foods. Why do Florida avocados taste like water balloons? Have you noticed the difference?
Yeah, I don't have many Florida avocados. Typically, I get the Haas ones. Although I'm growing down here, I live in North Central Florida, so there's you can still grow the Haas types. There's different variants. So they take a while to mature. So my trees are just starting to bear fruit now.
Oh, that's a lovely time. Yeah. The avocado thing is something that a lot of like Californians don't know, but there's tropical avocados and there's the Haas variety, which are like creamier, and the nutrition factors for them are very different. Like the amount of fat you'll get from one species of avocado versus another, if from memory, I think it's about a 30% difference in the amount of fat, because there's just
which more. One has more of the Haas?
The Haas, yeah. The tropical ones you get in Hawaii or Florida, or sometimes like in Vietnam or somewhere in Southeast Asia, they're just watery. So instead of the fat, there's water. And they're still good for you, but you just have to eat more of them. And I don't know about the sugar content difference, but I was astounded when I had, you know, Hawaiian guacamole. I'm like, what's wrong with this? It didn't have the creamy character to it that I'd come to expect.
Yeah, the Florida avocados are really big.
Yeah. But,
I typically get them also. So typically I go up one a day, so they're good. They're really good in smoothies too. You can't use a full one. You've got to use like a third or even a quarter.
Yeah, because they're just big.
Yeah.
Now, there's a few things that I'd love to run through that are controversial, where you've been a leading voice on these. And these are ones where generally I'm in alignment with what you say there. And I think that your research is sound and that you've got a lot of courage because you just come out there and say some things like, look, this is the way it is. But there's always controversy on the internet. One of them, let's talk about aspartame. Can you give me like the short rundown based on your experience, based on your research, of why it's bad, what it does?
Well, aspartame, it was about aspartame, right?
So, yeah.
Okay, so aspartame is the most pernicious artificial sweetener. I wrote a book earlier, which is called Sweet Deception. It was really targeted for Splenda. In fact, was threatened by Johnson & Johnson before it published it, that if we published it, they were going to sue us. It was like a 20-page letter from a big New York law firm.
Nice.
And nevertheless, we spent a little extra time on our references and documentation, but they never sued us because everything we said was true. But the reason why aspartame is the worst, because it's the most toxic. And briefly, it's pivoted as being natural, but it's essentially an ester bond between phenylalanine and aspartic acid. And when it breaks down to the body, your body doesn't have the metabolic machinery to detoxify like other species do. Humans just don't. And as a result, it goes into the body, passes the blood-brain barrier, and there it's detoxified to methanol, a potent neurotoxin. Methanol, formaldehyde. The methanol breaks down to the formaldehyde. And the formaldehyde is just, it destroys your brain cells and denatures your DNA. It's bad news. So toxic as can be, it causes seizures, it can can cause seizures, migraines, even brain tumors. It's really clear. The evidence is uncontroversial if you carefully analyze it. And if you look at the studies that were published early on, it was like 85% of the studies that were done by industry showed that there was no problem, whereas 90% of the ones that were independent showed problems with it. So it was really clear. Thankfully, industry has caught up to this, I think largely as a result of our targeted exposure on this. If you type in aspartame on the internet, using Google, we'll come up number two. So they didn't like
for
that.
You.
the sales of diet sodas in general, aspartame being the leading component, most of the diet sodas are down 6% the last 2 years. So what does that translate to? I was kind of curious, you know, what type of impact we have financially on these companies. Do you know what that number is? 6% decrease in sales annually?
It's got to be like $3 billion or something.
$10 billion.
Oh, I love that.
$10 billion loss. So just recently, Pepsi announced that they're taking aspartame out.
That is the biggest win ever, by the way. And just full credit, your voice has been one of the ones that made that happen. Like, you really have been leading that. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I don't know that many are aware of that, but, you know, it's been important for us. And in fact, well, there's some interesting developments that you will see next year that will literally blow the top off of the entire diet industry. You know, we've got some things in the works that it's going to be mainstream news, front page, and you will be surprised next year once this thing launches. It's really exciting. We're taking them down.
It is. Because
So, you know, a while ago we realized – you know, I can provide information. We've been doing this for just about 20 years, 18 years this year. Actually, so 18 years. So 5 years ago, we said, listen, you can continue to educate people. And we do that, but we have to play a more aggressive role. So we turned into an activist. And we've been active in the GMO labeling issue. And I think we're going to be victorious there, too. We're definitely changing, causing changes in the direction of Monsanto and these other evil corporations. So, and we're making progress. So but someone needed to step up and take a leadership role and work with other people, you know, to get them coordinated, collaborated to focus on this, because they outnumber us in volume of influence of their resources. I mean, they have access to billions and billions of dollars, and we just have millions, a few millions. That's nothing compared to that number is more than 1,000 to 1. So we copy a lot of their strategies because their strategies work.
Yep.
And it's pretty interesting what you can do if you're committed and you're dedicated and you coordinate it with a lot of like-minded individuals, which there's some incredible people out there. So we just connect with them, work together cohesively, and, you know, basically we're able to clobber them. And we will ultimately be victorious in many of these fronts.
Just maybe last year, I went to a conference at Stanford on neuromarketing, which is, you know, using brain science to look at the brains of people as they look at what's happening with ads. So you look at an ad, what does it do to your brain? And sitting right next to me was the CMO from Monsanto. Mm-hmm. And when you're saying their ad techniques work, well, the big companies like that really do go out and do every little thing they can do.
Yes. They can afford it.
Yeah, they can.
It's crazy not to. And it is amazing how effective you can be when you're dealing with garbage and lies and deception and fraud, because these techniques are so powerful. So it's not just like that's a technique, but there's even more powerful strategic interventions that you can do, and they aggressively deploy. So we learn by following what they're doing, and we deploy similar strategies because they work, and it's pretty effective. You know, how we're able to make some dents. And one of the most recent ones was the strategy. Well, I can't go into that because it's still in discussion.
Don't mess anything up. You're doing good work.
it's pretty amazing what you can do.
So when you talk about we, obviously you're not in this all by yourself.
I'm pretty much the voice. I'm the, you know, I get some of the ideas, and I'm the content team leader, but I have a whole team that's responsible. The person that runs the company is Steve Rye, and he's a really high power, strategic, incredibly good thinker. I mean, I just spoke to him today. He's going out to Denver tomorrow, and he's going to be meeting with the American grass fed people out there and slow meat. And, you know, I don't know if you're aware, but most grass fed beef in the U.S. is not grown in the U.S.
It's Australian and New Zealand. And
so we're changing that. We're in the changing that. There's American Grass-Fed Beef Association. We're cooperating with them. We're having this whole big strategy of raising the beef that we eat in the U.S. on properly 100% pasture-raised beef. And then using the byproducts, the organs and a lot of the other things for foods and for pet foods. And there's so many things that can be done that just, you know, people weren't interested in, but we have the ability to take that knowledge, coordinate things, and then offer to people because, you know, we've got the influence of reaching a lot of people. We're reaching 10 million unique visitors every month now. So
that is unbelievable.
It's grown so much.
Bulletproof gets 10% of that. And one of the things that I learned from, I went grass-fed more than 10 years ago as part of restoring my wife's fertility. And I just will not eat grain-fed meat because it makes me feel awful. Yeah. And the Bulletproof Coffee Shop is a restaurant opening in Santa Monica actually this month. And we are featuring grass-fed beef, but not just grass-fed beef from this ranch and then from this ranch and then from this ranch, just like wine. Winery is different. Beef from this beefery is different.
Sure. And
we want to show people, like, taste it, see how you feel. And because once they taste it once at the Bulletproof Coffee Shop, they can go out and they can get grass-fed beef and find out the difference it makes for them. And that will change the demand for grass-fed beef, which will, of course, change the supply, which is what you're talking about doing. And thanks for that work.
Yeah. The problem is you have to have a finishing operation, which actually butchers the cattle, and it can't be mixed up. It has to be dedicated to them, and you need a large volume for that to work. So it's just a matter of coordinating the efforts and the supply so they can keep that plant busy.
There's also differences in when you're butchering grass-fed cattle, when you cool the carcasses. If you cool them wrong, it's tough. If you cool them right, it's tender. And it's just different than grain-fed meat. So a lot of places just aren't equipped to do the work. And
it's the devil's in the details. Got to do it right, otherwise it's not going to work. But once it's done right, it's an amazing food.
It really is. This year, when I'm home, all of the beef that I eat actually ate the grass from the front part of my property. So we're raising the grass, but not the cows yet. And it makes a difference in how you feel and how your kids perform, how your brain performs.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, ideally, you know, one of my passions is regenerative agriculture. Mm-hmm. Because some of the projections are that within the next 60 years, we're going to lose most of the topsoil on the planet.
Yeah.
And we'll not be able to sustain the human race. So it's a relatively urgent need. It's not 60 years away, but it's not that far. So, but what I learned is that integrating animals into the process is a really powerful way to do that. And some of the best soil ever developed on Earth supposedly is in the American Great Plains when they had all these herbivores, these buffaloes that were depositing their waste and trampling it in and having these cocktail cover crops grow up that furthered the amount of organic content and carbon they can integrate into the soil.
Well, let's talk about glyphosate or Roundup. It's an antibiotic. It kills bacteria. When you spray it on that healthy soil, what happens to the soil?
Well, a number of things. It chelates out the minerals. It's also a thing. It's originally patented as a chelator and an antibiotic. The reason it works as an antibiotic is it takes away the minerals, like zinc and manganese are two of the most potent ones. But it is bad news. It really devastates if you put glyphosate or Roundup is actually much more toxic. Some of the studies show it might be 100, 200 times more toxic than glyphosate because the surfactants in Roundup make it much worse. Totally disrupts cell membranes, mitochondria. It's bad news. So if you put it in sterile soil, guess what? It doesn't work. That's not its mechanism of action. The way it works is through the soil microbes. And then they cause diseases to the plant that basically cripple it because its immune system is severely compromised. And it's really devastating. Because not only is it the issue with GMO crops and the Roundup that they're spraying on it, but they're actually spraying it on non-GMO crops.
Yeah.
You know, like wheat, like who doesn't eat wheat? Like virtually very few people. So they use it to dry it. And it's just as damn dangerous once it gets in there because it's integrated into every single cell of the plant. They use it to kill the wheat and then dry it out. And it's you cannot wash this stuff off. So you eat, the average American, how much glyphosate or Roundup do you think the average American is eating every year?
You know, I've never quantified it, but it's got to be a ridiculous amount because it's sprayed on a crop. You eat the crop.
It's their body weight, about 150 pounds every year.
How can that
be? They're not eating that much glyphosate. They're eating that much food sprayed with glyphosate and integrated into cells.
I'm sorry. Okay.
but they're spraying basically a billion pounds of this stuff every year. So it is dangerous as can be. It's just it's absolutely ridiculous that they're getting away with the sham. And it all relates to this this legislation. I don't know if you saw my interview with Stephen Drucker, who wrote the book Twisted Genes. Altered. He knew about this stuff 10 years before I did, and he actually sued the FDA in 1997 for their 1992 ruling on glyphosate that essentially allowed it to be grass generally recognized as safe, which was the central reason why it's used worldwide now because of that 1992 FDA ruling. And he actually, through clever, deceptive techniques, his case was dismissed. And even though they showed the basis of it, said it wasn't relevant to this case because it was introduced after they made the decision. And it's just so insane. If you just, it's really a phenomenal book. And he helped me understand that it's not so much Monsanto that's really the pernicious evil in this whole operation. Who do you think was responsible for this if it isn't Monsanto?
They're
the bullet.
DuPont,
who pulled the trigger?
I would guess.
Who's that?
DuPont, I would guess.
No, it's not a company. They're just like, those are bullets. The one who pulled the trigger was the molecular biologist. Scam above all. If they weren't in on this collusion, they would have never gotten away with it. There's no way the FDA would have ever made that ruling in 1992. It became over 20, it was about 18 years. They just, because they introduced genetically modified, genetically engineered products. And then there was this really bad feedback from the public. Says, no, we can't have that. So they said, oh, this isn't going to work. We got to change our strategy. So they all got together and had agreed to tone down this thing. And they just took that strategy thinking that if the public disagreed with us, we can't get our funding. So they were all really in collusion to this. And a few of them weren't. And they wrote, you know, they basically helped save us, from, you know, some of these early molecular biologists. But essentially it was the molecular biologists that ruined this whole strategy. So, you know, the professional scientific community, you know, and you remember that speech that Eisenhower gave when he was president, when he was basically leaving the office. Remember how he warned us of the military-industrial complex? Remember that?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen videos of it. It's quite a famous video. But he also warned the scientific elite, even as much as the military-industrial complex. And that's what the problem we have. That's the problem we have with molecular biologists and the safety of GMO foods. It's the same damn problem we have with vaccines. You know, that they get away with this nonsense, that they can essentially mandate it for the entire population or virtually the entire population with virtually no assurances or guarantees of safety. No, we just want to do it.
One of the things about glyphosate that's really interesting to me is that when you spray it on fungus, it causes the fungus to make a lot more mycotoxin. And I've just completed, and I'm watching next week, a film called Moldy. And I've for 2 years been filming this. I've interviewed guys like Richie Shoemaker, Mark Hyman, Daniel Amen, and a whole bunch of people have been affected by environmental mold growing in their homes. And we tortured our soil microbes so much that the fungus in the soil started making more toxins than it did historically. There's been genetic changes and there's been toxin level changes. And glyphosate's one of the things that made what grows behind your drywall so toxic. So the connection between what's happening in our homes and what's happening in our cropland and in our soil is undeniable, but it's almost unheard of. So I'm particularly interested in the angle of, okay, if some plants get sick when you spray glyphosate or Roundup on them, what happens to the fungus? Are you familiar with that story? And you've written some things about it, but that may have been your team. Are you up to date on mycotoxins?
I just interviewed Suzanne Summers, and her notebook is Tox Sick.
Yeah.
TXSSEK. And she and her husband were both exposed. Her husband was had a progressive neurological disease, and they wanted to do something. They basically thought he was dead.
Yeah.
And she was diagnosed as cancer. And they dealt, then it didn't, no one figured out it was toxic mold going to this home that they was in, because her home in Malibu was destroyed and they had to go into this rental home, which is really high end home, but it was loaded with toxic mold in the basement. So she figured it out and got better and didn't go on any of the anti-cancer drugs. But, you know, the 70% of the microbes in the soil are fungal.
Yeah.
And that really is, that's one of the reasons why I'm so excited about using wood chips as a soil amendment to build, not only increase the concentration of carbon in the soil, but to actually massively increase the mycorrhizal fungi, increase earthworm population, decrease irrigation needs, decrease the need, almost eliminate the use of fertilizers. So it's a beautiful thing. And when you do these things and you have the, you use these proper biological regenerative agricultural approaches, you don't need products like glyphosate and Roundup, yeah, which devastate the soil microbiology, cause the fungal elements to mutate to the point where they're making toxins that are even more pernicious to humans and certainly not beneficial for the plants. So they just upset this whole ecological balance, and they push it in the wrong direction. And you don't have to do that. You know, it really is sad if you just simple basic principles. And I love regenerative agriculture because it's such a, it's like, it was initially, it was a puzzle to me. I didn't know how to get plants to grow healthy. But there's a lot of similarities between that and health. So I was able, yeah, to pick it up relatively quickly. And, you know, I'm in the middle of this pilot project on my own personal property to see how it works. And once it does, I'm going to promote, my next book will be Effortless Gardening, and hopefully encourage a nationwide repeat of what we did in World War II with the Victory Gardens, where the vast majority of the produce produced in the United States was grown in people's backyards, which I think is really the, where we're heading towards, because if we're in 60 years, not going to have any commercial topsoil left, that's not a good thing.
And we're,
the only way you'll be able to get to food is your own food is grow it. And that's a good thing, because you can make incredibly nutrient-dense food if you grow it locally. And, you know, another important part of the growing your own healthy food is our minerals. Obviously, that's one of the reasons why, you know, even organically grown food isn't necessarily good, because it depends on if the, what they did with the soil and how they were able to bring the mineral content up. And one of the things I've learned is that minerals from the ocean can be very useful here if you're able, yeah, to effectively remove all the sodium chloride, which can be highly toxic to most plants, especially citrus plants. But if you remove them all, then you've got 62 minerals that usually can catalyze these rate-limited actions, and you can maximize the genetic potential of the plant. So, I mean, it's just when you use these things, typically in their ionic ocean minerals, and you do them in a foliar spray, unbelievable. You just see tremendous growth, resistance to disease, and, you know, the taste and the flavor of the food is just incredible. So it's amazing with simple things like ground cover and these minerals and, you know, healthy seeds, heirloom seeds, you know, the type of food that you can produce.
It's remarkable. I live about a 10-minute walk from the ocean. And this year, my family will grow all of its own food, which people...
Excellent. That's hard to do.
It is. We're on 32 acres, and we're turning it into an organic permaculture farm. So, like, we're in very much alignment there. And people say...
Do you circulate your family's waste back into the land?
Well, we have a septic tank, so from that perspective, we do. But do you mean like compost waste or something else?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I do for my own urine. I live in a regular, well, I guess it's a suburb, mm-hmm, municipality. But I save all my urine and I put that in the plants, you know, diluted, of course.
That's got to be really good for them. I do something a little simpler since, well, you can't see anyone from where I live. I just walk out and pee wherever I feel like, because the old fashioned way. Exactly.
So you got to have chickens for sure. That's easy.
There will be ducks and geese, but they're not in yet.
Oh, okay.
Good. Yeah. Ducks eat slugs better than chickens, and chickens are, I don't know, they're common.
I didn't know.
And duck eggs are also so creamy and delicious.
What works for slugs too is something called Sluggo, S-L-U-G-G-O.
Copper stuff or?
No, it's a natural product. It's like, I think it's iron pyrophosphate.
Okay.
And it's toxic as heck to slugs, and it's a nutrient in the soil. So it's a win-win.
Well, that works. Well, so people who are listening now might be going, oh my God, Dave and Dr. Mercola just started talking about killing slugs and ducks. And the whole point, the reason that we're talking about this is that you and I both care very much about health and how we feel. And if you want control of your biology, if you want to actually be in charge of your life, you got to be in charge of what you put in your mouth. And yeah, right now, not only is this a cost-effective way to do it, but this is a way to get higher quality than you could buy at the grocery store for any amount of money. And that's why it's worth doing it. And that's why if you want to really like make a lot of money as a young person, start a business where you go and you manage the garden for someone in their backyard when they're too busy to do it. There's a huge way for that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of science and technology, and I'm absolutely convinced of the eventual integration of artificial general intelligence, which will eliminate literally tens of millions of jobs. I mean, you know, we have an unemployment problem already in this country. There's no question. It's going to get massively worse. There's no way the economy in this country is going to get any better anytime soon. It just isn't. That's a fact. So that's great advice you have. That is one good strategy you can have, because people need to eat. So if you can become proficient at these tools and techniques and serve them in that way, you'll always have a job.
Yeah. And there's also something that comes from like Buddhist teachings. And the Buddhists say, minimize the number of people who touch your food, which is, okay, I have no idea whether that's scientifically validated, but there's something to it.
Makes sense. I mean, you can't process it if not that many people are touching it.
Right.
It's just more difficult.
You can't process it. And it may be something more subtle than that, where like there's something about, oh, this cucumber grew in my backyard and I'm eating it for dinner. Like it may synchronize you with your biome. There's talk about communication between soil microbes and the microbes in your stomach. And maybe there's benefits to having the soil microbes from your backyard talk to the things in your stomach to tell your system about what's going on in the environment. There's just stuff we don't know, but you feel better when you eat this.
No question. You know, you asked early on one of the other things I was doing, and I think it was like 5 years ago now, I had dinner with Dr. Natasha McCampbell McBride.
Yeah.
And she is a neurologist who has a son with autism and got passionate about this and now does that full time. But she's really known for the GAPS diet, which is gut-associated psychology syndrome.
Yeah.
And you know, the basic strategy there is ultimately to use fermented food. She has a lot of bone broths for a transitional diet that she has puts people on, but ultimately people wind up on the fermented foods to optimize your gut. So I started doing that once after I had dinner with her, and you know, basically realized that these bacteria are making a lot of good things. Not only are you getting the volume of the beneficial microbes, but I said, well, how many are we getting? You know, because we sell a really good high potency probiotic with incredible strains, one of the best on the market, but that that I think one or two capsules is 100 billion, which is pretty high potency.
Yeah.
So I said, well, if I'm eating the fermented vegetables, how many are in there? So we did the analysis. It was like 10 trillion. It was more than a whole bottle of our probiotics in just in 2 or 3 ounces of the fermented vegetables. So I said, well, this is good. I don't need to take any more probiotics. And then I said, well, let's make this better, because one of the important nutrients that most people don't get enough of, I mean, almost everyone seeing this video is deficient in this, is vitamin K2.
Yes.
Now, I was one of the guys who really heavily promoted the use of vitamin D. Probably that was the main catalyst to get it implemented and adopted in the United States. I didn't invent it or anything, of course, but I just popularized it.
You and Dr. Kennel.
Endlessly persistent with it.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful that people have adopted it, but vitamin D works in conjunction with K2, and it is massively important for increasing your bone density, but more important, reducing cardiovascular disease, because it sucks out the calcium from the lining of the blood vessel and puts it back into the bone. And you can have the best vitamin D levels in the world, and it's not going to do that. It's not designed to work that way. It needs to work with K2. So where do you get K2? It's fermented foods. The highest source in the world is natto, which is produced by a species of bacteria called Bacillus subtilis. And so I said, let's see if we can do something. So we changed, we had the starter culture that I made my fermented foods with. We changed and played with it. We got to the point where it's making 400 or 500 micrograms of vitamin K2.
Wow.
And typically a vitamin K2 supplement is about 200 micrograms. And it's pricey. It's $1 or $2 a pill. So you could ferment your own food with this specific starter culture. We've developed one called Kinetic Starter Culture, and it makes you get vitamin K2 for free, and you get 10 trillion bacteria. It's like
you have
to spend like $50 of supplements every day to equal that, and it's real food.
Is that something you sell?
Yeah, with the Kinetic Culture, but you got to make the vegetables yourself.
That's so interesting. One of my biggest complaints about fermented food, Dr. McCullough, has been that you don't know what it is. Because most people, just dump their cabbage in a bucket, and then they don't control temperature, they don't control time, and they don't know what their starter culture is. So they're getting histamine, they're getting
weird species. Well, a lot of people make mild fermentation.
Yeah.
Rather than getting a week, it takes 3 weeks to do it, and it's an experiment, you know?
Yeah. Wild fermentation, I think, can be dangerous because of what we just talked about, where things like the spraying of the soil changes the toxicity of the fungus. So then all of a sudden you get yeast out there, and what's happening, whatever that yeast is making, maybe is good for you, maybe it isn't, but you just don't know. It's kind of a fermentation roulette from my perspective.
Yeah. So that's a good tech tip. And, you know, I just had a discussion with my CEO right before this call, and I didn't realize it's still relatively, it's not appreciated. Vitamin K2 is an emerging, and it's really only a very small number of people who understand this. Probably a good percentage of your audience, I would assume, but it's huge. It's important. It's a very small fraction of people who understand vitamin D. So the best way to do it is to just get it for free in the food you make. I mean, you could buy a supplement and swallow it, but, you know, why do it when you get it for free?
You can also do the good old-fashioned cultured butter. And I'm well known for promoting butter.
I don't think it has – you need about 200 micrograms. Mm-hmm. And I don't – depending on the way you should to culture it, I don't know if it would be therapeutically or clinically useful. It might only be like 20, 30 micrograms.
Interesting. I'll check that
out.
You have to
look it up or send it to a lab and measure it if you're going to use it regularly.
It also depends on the quality of the butter and the quality of the fermentation and all. So I'll actually take that as
a and it's, kind of, butter is good for other reasons. I go through a pound of butter almost every week, certainly every 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
I love butter.
It's ridiculous for me what adding butter back in. I was a raw vegan for a while. And you know, I used to weigh 300 pounds and had mold toxicity and Lyme disease and chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, like the whole, all the bad things you could get. And man, what a difference putting butter back in with my vegetables made.
Yeah, it's good. It's good stuff. It really is. It should be raw and grass-fed, ideally.
Yeah, well, I think grass-fed is terribly important. And raw, if you can find it, great. But if you find cultured, not raw, but still grass-fed, there's lots of benefits to that. Yeah, it'll work, but it's not the best. Now, something that can affect fermentation and something that can affect other things like your gut microbe is fluoride. And you've also been one of those guys out there who's been saying for many, many years, like, fluoride's a drug. And I know my grandfather was a fluoride chemist on the Manhattan Project, and he's like, I wouldn't put that stuff anywhere near my body. But I drank water with it as a kid, and my teeth show excessive fluoride, and I don't touch the stuff. I don't let my kids touch the stuff. Why should people listening to this podcast consider making sure there's no fluoride in their water? Like, what's bad about it?
Well, right now we have 40% of American adolescents have dental fluorosis, which is cosmetic damage to the outside of their teeth, which is what sounds like that you had when you were younger.
Yep.
So that's one, but that's just cosmetic. But you got to think, if it's causing my teeth to be discolored, what the heck is it doing to my bones?
Yep.
It is not good. I mean, it's well documented to cause osteonecrosis of the jaw. I mean, it's fact. So, and that's one of the dangers, but it can lead to, it's a halogen. One of the other pernicious problems with it, especially if you're a woman, you know, hypothyroidism is sort of an epidemic in the Western world, and fluoride will actually displace the iodine from the thyroid, causing you to be relatively hypothyroid. So it's really hard to get fluoride out of the water. Now, it sounds like where you live, it's not an issue because you've got your own well. It sounds like it's 32 acres. But if you live in a municipality, it's almost invariably going to be fluoridated. We were successful in keeping fluoride out of the water of Portland, the 28th largest city in the United States. And they've always been fluoride free, but the city council there decided, we're going to change this. And the pro-fluoride movement says we're going to make an example of Portland. But we were able to intervene 2 years ago and help them in their support to defeat that initiative. So fluoride is the largest city in the U.S. that's not fluoridated.
But Portland has special powers. They've been able to block Uber, which is just insane. No, I don't know how anyone could do that. But that city will go to the ends of the earth to do what it wants. So I'm pleased that they did that.
Yeah, I'm pleased too. Although I don't know about Uber. I'm a big fan.
No, me too. I love Uber. But
I like this technology. It just seems to make so much sense.
If you can stop Uber, you have almost unlimited power. That's what I'm saying. I also take Uber. I don't rent cars anymore. I was kind of sad when I got to Portland. I didn't know what to do, but I hitchhiked. It was almost the same.
Yeah, that'll work. But you know, it clearly will be a non-issue in the relatively near future because we're going to have self-driving cars. They exist now, I own a Tesla, and I'm told within the next month they'll be able to have software download. We'll be able to self-drive on the highway. It'll be here, and you won't have to own a car. You're just calling up on your phone, bing bing, it comes and picks you up. You don't have to worry about insurance, parking, none of that stuff. Your garage, you can use your garage for an office.
A lot of people probably don't know that about you, but you're a technology, kind of a futurist guy. And I hang out with Peter Diamandis and the SpaceX people.
I don't know him personally, but he's a good guy.
And I'm a member of his mastermind, his Abundance 360. And I've had the great fortune to spend several days with him. And all of the guys at that level are saying exactly what you're saying, which is, self-driving cars, they're not 10 years away. They're happening.
No.
Mining asteroids for minerals. Like, I've held the equipment that is being sent to the asteroids in my own hands.
Yeah.
Like, this is happening. The world is changing in a way that we don't know about. But the thing that sucks is that you and I both know this, but it doesn't matter if we have self-driving cars if there isn't any food because we killed our soil.
No. Or you're sick as can be because you've eaten the wrong food.
We can have only self-driving ambulances. That's the only thing we'll need to just shuttle us back and forth.
Totally true. Most of those guys don't understand the health component. They really don't. At least that's been my experience.
Well, they didn't, but I the last time I was at one of these groups, there's 20 of these guys with more money than the average person by orders of magnitude. And I pulled out my little crack bag full of vitamins. I take 100 supplements a day, probably. Yeah. And instead of looking at me like a crazy person like they have for years in Silicon Valley, most of these guys said, "Oh, you too?" And they pull out their own little bags of vitamins. They're all paying attention. Like that is a big change, as important as self-driving cars. Because
It's not the supplements, it's the food.
Well, they're doing both, right?
You have to have key food.
If you eat crap, supplements won't fix it. But if you eat great food, supplements still help, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I take enough myself. One of the other things I'm doing, an associated tangent, because of an artifact of not sitting well, I'm walking. So I walk 2 hours a day when I'm home. And I usually walk it on the beach. So I'm able to read. Now I can read 2 books a week as my average. Sometimes it's 1, sometimes it's 3. But I've read both of Peter's books, Bold and Abundance.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've read the biography of Elon Musk recently. I mean, it was just published a few weeks ago.
It's on my list. I heard the author on NPR.
It is just beyond fantastic. You have to read this book. It is one of the most inspiring books I've read in a long, long time. I mean, he is an amazing individual, absolutely amazing. And he will go down. He will far eclipse Steve Jobs and Bill Gates together.
I met him at SpaceX. I almost called it Steve X. met him at SpaceX. The guy is unstoppable mentally. He's driven by something I've not seen before, but
the key to be successful is to be passionate. And boy, I mean, if you look up passion in the dictionary, he's going to probably have his name there. I mean, it's and the book does it's written so well, and it just details all the experiences, the great amount of experience he had in his life that demonstrates that passion and that commitment, that drive, that dedication is just insurmountable in the midst of what appears to be imminent failure on multiple times. So it was a really inspiring book, very encouraging for anyone.
What it makes me think about, Dr. Mercola, is how you and I and a few other people can be the Elon Musks of our soil, because we need that level of innovation to fix what's already been done to the soil. And without that level of world changing, it's going to be kind of ugly 100 years from now. And it's fixable though. I absolutely believe it.
And we're making changes and trends. I mean, it's just, you got to get this critical threshold or tipping point of people to understand, appreciate, and apply it. And it starts to spread. So that's my new passion, is really is regenerative agriculture. That's wow. where I spend a lot of my spare time, I understand this deeper and really applying it and start to teach it to individuals.
I had no idea. So we're so much in alignment on that. Maybe if I'm in Florida sometime, I'll look you up. If we both are in the same same place, I'll look your garden. And if you're ever on Vancouver Island, you're always invited to come check out mine.
Which island are you on?
I'm on main Vancouver Island. I'm looking out over Salt Spring, but I'm on the Vancouver Island side.
Yeah, that's a nice area.
Now we're coming up on the end of the show, and there's one question that I've asked everyone on the show, and I think your answers might be different than anyone else after a couple hundred episodes. And it's, given everything you know from your work and just from your life, if someone came to you today and said, like, I want to perform better at anything, what are your top three recommendations? Like, if you want to kick more ass, do these three things.
Perform better at anything.
Yeah, whatever you're here to do. So some people are moms, some people are dads,
sure.
Some people are entrepreneurs, some people play soccer, whatever you love.
Well, clearly, based on the core of my understanding of how to optimize your health is to not be insulin resistant.
Okay.
So do whatever it takes to not be insulin resistant. Typically, if you are, that's going to be intermittent fasting. And all the principles we've talked about or alluded to in this conversation, which is, you know, healthy fats and minimizing the grains, the fruits, all of that. So, be insulin and leptin resistant, because it's causing, it's actually even more important, but it's easier to measure insulin. I think a hidden one that I ignored for many, many years and have come to more fully appreciate is sleep, and make sure you're sleeping 8 hours. It sounds simple and stupid, and your parents probably told you about it all, for years. But, most of us think that we're exceptions, especially if you're hard driving, you've got a lot of stuff to do and no time left to do, and you've got a family, so you compromise your sleep. So make sure you're getting 8 hours of sleep would be a huge. And I think really, well, three is hard. one of the things is, I focus on is your fluid intake. And, from my perspective, is to optimize your water. And there's a lot of ways to do that. We didn't talk about them, but structured water is massively important. Making sure you're structuring it with the specific types of minerals. Structured water is sort of energized water. It's water inside of cells. It's the water that you get if you take a fruit and squeeze the juice out of it, or a vegetable, and you have vegetable juice. All that water is structured. Vegetable does it. Or the plant does it for you. But there are mechanical devices that will structure it for you too. And then you can also have water that's high in hydrogen gas, which is a whole topic that would take about an hour to explain. But that's sort of what happens in our gut, is this the production of hydrogen gas. So that's kind of all related to the water intake. So if you're drinking hot, healthy water, you're not drinking soda or Gatorade or these other power drinks, that people tend, like Red Bull or something, that people need to stay healthy.
The opposite healthy. Of structured water, right?
Yeah. So, and then what's this? Did I get three?
That was three. You had insulin resistance, structured water, and sleep.
Yeah. So those are some basics, but there's so many more that you could talk about, like passion
Let's do three more. Like, if you'll be the only guy to get a bonus three because you spent your life doing this stuff, what would your next three be?
What we talked about is just to be passionate, because that will drive you. And Elon's a classic example there. It says, if you just truly, authentically, not academically, intellectually, but at your core, just passionate about something, you're going to be successful at whatever it is, as long as it's your true, authentic passion. Yeah. So that's key. And it's sort of an artifact of that is to be joyful. As part of that process, and sort of a secondary effect from sleep is meditation, which I think is another powerful discipline that certainly a lot of people appreciate and do, but many people fail to implement. So I've been playing with that for the last year, and able to meditate for about 30 minutes a day. And I use a technology that is actually able to monitor my brain waves. They can tell me what levels of meditation.
You and me both. I love it.
So that's what I do. And, love, that's the ultimate core in driving, so in your relationships, ideally your spouse, or your children, your parents, and your relatives and friends. So, I think that's the key.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Mercola, thank you for being on Bulletproof Radio today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for all you do. You're doing some great work there, spreading. There's not a lot of people that understand this at the core level, like you do. So appreciate you spreading the word. And congratulations. I think the last time I looked, you're in the top 10 natural health sites. That's pretty darn good.
It's quite an achievement. Thank you so much. I'm working to help a lot of people similar to the way you are.
Obviously you are. And just remember that the more people you help with this information, the more you're going to be vilified.
Yeah.
They don't like that.
I've kind of noticed that. And it actually threw me for a little while. And thanks to some encouragement from JJ Virgin.
Yeah.
I think, you know, she really helped me out. And Michael Fishman and actually Tim Ferriss too. He's a good guy. He's like, here's how to deal with them. Like, oh, that's right. So I just don't worry about it, you know? And you've certainly been vilified, but from, from what I can see, you're directionally accurate. And if there's something that needs tweaking, you've shown a willingness to change your recommendations, like eat more fat, like add intermittent fasting, like add high intensity interval training. Over the years, you've clearly evolved and been very public about it. So like, what else can people ask for?
Yeah, just be honest and know the life's a journey, and it's, you know, just share what you learn and be honest about it. So that's all.
Awesome.
All right. Well, thanks again, Dave. Thanks for all your work, and keep up the good work.
All right. If you enjoyed today's show, do me a favor, go out there and check out Effortless Healing, Dr. Mercola's book, and check out his work because it's good work. And while you're at it, I would love it if you went on to iTunes and you said, Bulletproof Radio rocks, give us a thumbs up or a star, whatever you do on iTunes to say that we're good. Thank you so much.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.